Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Naked Archaeology, exposing the finds.
Hello and welcome to a truly international Naked Archaeology with me, Diana O'Carroll in England. Tom Birch has dialed in from Scotland.
Hello.
And Duncan Howard-Marshall is joining us from Greece.
Hello.
This month, Fire and the Fury, we explore warfare in Bronze Age Aegean art. Just how true to the archaeology was the film Troy?
Well, I did see the film Troy. It was pretty good, actually, and I liked it, but it's not accurate at all, especially about the warriors. Of course, there are some pretty nice parts which are correct. I mean, we could all see the famous boar tusk helmet, a helmet made of wild boar's teeth, sliced teeth, which was a reality in the iconography, and, in fact, several pieces have been found in burials.
Angelos Papadopoulos there. We'll be hearing about his research on warrior images in just a moment. Plus, fighting fire with fire. Did it turn up in Europe just as the Neanderthals did?
This increase in the number of sites shows it's a technology that is slowly getting diffused, and to us indicates that the Neanderthals had an habitual use of fire, because you find sites that have many fireplaces in different layers, one on top of each other. To me, all this suggests that they knew how to make fires.
Paola Villa discusses her findings on European fire use very soon. Tom?
In the news this month, genetic diversity and how it tallies with our ancestors, and the early seafarers paddling off the Californian coast. Plus, in backyard archaeology, I'm throwing spears.
Laying the artifacts bare. Naked Archaeology.
First up this month, Bronze Age warriors in Aegean art. If you've ever visited a museum, you will almost certainly have seen an ancient Greek or Mycenaean piece of pottery, covered in images of armour-clad men with spears or swords. But what do these portrayals of fighting men mean? Are they accurate? Analysing the story behind these depictions, Angelos Papadopoulos.
Well, the whole thing started about 10 years ago at the University of Liverpool when I was doing my PhD thesis on the iconography of warfare in the Aegean Bronze Age. You see, I've always been working on the subject of iconography, the study of iconography, so this was a pretty cool subject to deal with and very interesting. So eventually the whole research focused on the entire Bronze Age of the Aegean from, let's say, 3000 BC up until 1100 BC. And it covered images and pictures of warriors and hunters as depicted in the Aegean art throughout all this time. Of course, this is only one aspect of the study of warfare in general, and other aspects, other fields include study of the fortification and architecture, technology of weapons, burial customs, and all of these join together and give us a good idea about Bronze Age warfare.
How are warriors actually depicted in Bronze Age art, on things like seal stones and faience objects and pottery?
It depends on the period. As you said, pottery and wall paintings and all kind of media have been used for this purpose. But initially, in the early Bronze Age, we could see statuettes made of marble depicting probably male individuals with baldricks and daggers. Later on, we could see them on seal stones or rings, people carrying spears or swords. Eventually, in the late Bronze Age, where technology was much more sophisticated, anybody could see battle scenes, groups of individuals fighting each other, either one or two combatants in duels, individual warriors appearing by themselves as a very powerful images, hunters killing lions or deer, and of course, they would be represented on almost every kind of material imaginable. Faience, pottery was very common, wall paintings in main palaces, and important buildings. As you said, seal stones, gold rings. It was a pretty big variety of objects.
Can you tell us why Bronze Age society decided to represent scenes of warfare in their art?
Well, humans always like to portray a warrior, a hunter, a man with weapons, because basically this shows power. In Egypt, for example, the pharaoh was pretty much portrayed as the mighty warrior in huge size, killing the enemies. Or in nearby Anatolia, the Hittites used to portray their gods armed and carrying weapons. So in the Aegean, we don't have a specific individual, let's say the equivalent of the pharaoh, to be portrayed. We don't have the ruler being the protector of the people. But the idea remained the same. The idea is that a mighty warrior with his weapons is a powerful symbol of authority, a powerful symbol used by elites and rulers in order to portray how strong and powerful they are, so they have legitimate authority. So, more or less, it was a pretty standard procedure for the entire prehistory all over the globe to portray warriors.
Now, I gather you've seen the film Troy, and I know it's going back a few years now, but I imagine many of our listeners would have seen it too. How accurate were the representations of warriors in that film? If we were to come face to face with a Bronze Age warrior from the Aegean now, how would he look? What sort of armor would he be wearing, and what kind of weapons would he be carrying?
Well, I did see the film Troy. It was pretty good, actually, and I liked it, but it's not accurate at all, especially about the warriors. Of course, there are some pretty nice parts which are correct. I mean, we could all see the famous boar's tusk helmet, a helmet made of wild boar's teeth, sliced teeth, which was a reality in the iconography, and in fact, several pieces have been found in burials. But in total, no, it was not accurate at all. However, again, depending on the period of the Bronze Age, let's say initially the standard practice, if we can say this, was to portray a hunter or a warrior mainly armed with a spear or a dagger. In the late Bronze Age, where technology, as I said, was much more sophisticated and representations were much more accurate and delicate and with small characteristics, let's say that the standard picture, judging from the wall paintings, which are probably the best medium, is to have a male warrior wearing his boar's tusk helmet, this was the standard type, carrying a large tower shield covering most of his body, and again having a sword and a long spear. Later on, at the end of the late Bronze Age, we could see in the wall paintings of some buildings in mainland Greece that shields were shorter and greaves appeared, possibly to protect the lower part of the body, the legs. So let's say that, especially in the late Bronze Age, for about 300 years, the standard image was exactly this: helmet, shield as protective gear, and greaves sometimes, and spears and swords as an offensive gear, sometimes bows too.
So with all these depictions and scenes of warfare in the cultural material record of the Bronze Age Aegean, can we say that it was a warlike world?
No, not really. Although this is a debate for the past, well, few decades among the archaeologists and the scholars of this period. No, of course we do have strong fortifications, we do have the Mycenaean Acropolis with Cyclopean walls all around them, burials of aerial periods with weapons. There is a very strong military characteristic, but we cannot really say that these people used to fight and combat all the time. The idea was that these weapons, these fortification walls, these images were nothing more than a symbol of authority, symbol of power, of military prowess, hunting ability, showing how strong the rulers were. Although none of them was actually represented, but by having in their property, by owning an object with a depiction of a warrior, automatically this meant they were capable of authority. So, no, they were not really warlike, but the image of the warrior was very common as a symbol.
So it was all pottering and no trousers, perhaps. That was Dr. Angelos Papadopoulos, who is a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Athens. And now it's time for some of the least contemporary news in the world. Tom?
Our first news story this month covers a recent research project on genetic diversity, which challenges the long-held view that the ancestors of all modern humans, Homo sapiens, originate from East Africa.
But I thought it was a pretty well-established fact that our species evolved and radiated out of East Africa. How does this study challenge that view?
Well, this study discovered that genetic diversity, which is an indicator of longevity and adaptability to the environment, crucial to the survival of any species, was found to be most diverse in populations in southern Africa. The study found that the genes of the Namibian and Kamani Bushmen in southern Africa, the Biaka Pygmies of central Africa, and the Sindawe of east Africa appear to be the most genetically diverse populations. Hence, they are likely to be the most ancient populations of modern humans.
Right, so how is genetic diversity an indicator of longevity?
Genetic diversity is absolutely fundamental to the adaptability of a species to the surrounding and changing environment. So as your population changes and evolves according to the environment, these adaptations will affect your overall genetic makeup. In other words, the longer you've been around, the more diverse your genetic characteristics are going to be.
Right, so is the study basically saying that our species still originated in Africa, it's just that our point of origin is somewhere further south?
Yes, but it's a bit more complicated than that. Co-author of the study, Brenna Henn from Stanford University, California, said that early human prehistory and evolution in Africa is a complex array of hundreds of distinct populations. The study was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences and came to two main conclusions. And the first is that there is much more genetic diversity in African hunter-gatherer populations than previously thought.
So East Africa might not be the so-called Garden of Eden?
Well, Chris Stringer from the Natural History Museum in London urges caution. Whilst he stated that the research is a landmark study on the genetic diversity of hunter-gatherer groups in Africa, we need to be careful not to over-localise these populations.
What do you mean by that?
Well, current hunter-gatherer populations have quite a limited range across the African landscape, but archaeology associated with many of these groups, in particular rock paintings that are linked to the Bushmen, strongly suggests that these populations were far more widespread in the past, ranging across most of sub-Saharan Africa. Stringer agrees that it's unlikely there was one single Garden of Eden where modern humans evolved, and that various populations in ancient Africa contributed to the genetic makeup and behaviours of modern humans.
If there's one thing about humans, they do like to move around a lot. Thanks, Tom. And just an update on the Egyptian antiquity story that we covered last month. Well, since then, there have been a few developments. Zahi Hawass actually resigned from his post. And although the latest reports are that he is still working from his office, he refuses to come back to his post until the Egyptian authorities promise to offer greater levels of protection for the archaeological sites across Egypt, which he has said are at high risk and are suffering from looting. So we hope that the situation over there does improve soon. Well, for our next news item, I got a report on some recent archaeological finds on the Channel Islands. Now, those aren't the Channel Islands that the UK is familiar with. These ones are off the coast of Southern California, and they could redefine our understanding of early human dispersal across the Americas.
That sounds like a pretty significant discovery. What have they found?
Well, a team of archaeologists and anthropologists working on the Californian Channel Islands have discovered a remarkable array of stone tools and animal remains dating to around 12,000 years ago, a time when the first human populations were migrating and settling across the Americas. These finds, recently reported in Science magazine, indicate that a very diverse maritime economy, which included shellfish, birds, and sea mammals, actually varied from island to island as well.
They must have also had pretty good seafaring technology to travel that far offshore in the first place. What's significance about the stone tools, Diana?
Well, I think this is the most intriguing part of the story. The stone tools found on the islands are very different to those found on the mainland. Mainland cultures, including Clovis and Folsom, were using tools with fluted points to hunt large mammals like the woolly mammoth. The islanders, on the other hand, diversified away from these cultures and established their own unique technology and subsistence strategies.
But what about the actual tools themselves? What do they look like?
Well, the tools include beautifully worked, thin, serrated points with barbs, which were no doubt used for hunting fish and, for the most part, do not reappear in the archaeological record after this time. And they're really striking and show an incredible level of craftsmanship.
What were these people doing in the Channel Islands? I thought the migrations across the Americas were along inland routes to South America and not along the coast.
You're right, but an increasing number of studies are challenging this simple linear view of the first peopling of the Americas. The evidence from the Channel Islands, that's a hunter-gatherer seafarer population with a rich and diverse maritime economy, may have been part of another dispersal route through the Americas, i.e. along the coast. The research team also found a piece of obsidian on the islands which comes from a mainland obsidian source hundreds of miles away and suggests that they were also engaged with long-distance exchange networks.
So there could have been lots of migration routes, overland and oversea, that crisscrossed their way across the continent.
Absolutely. In fact, Tom Delay, an anthropologist at Vanderbilt University, said that the evidence from the Channel Islands is a part of a mounting body of evidence for many different migration routes across the Americas, and further finds will no doubt shed more light on this hypothesis in the future. Further evidence may in fact come from potential underwater sites around the islands, and Dr. Rick Torben from the Smithsonian Institute in Washington, D.C., maintains that we need more pieces of the puzzle in order to get a better idea of what these people were doing 12,000 years ago.
Thanks, Diana. You're listening to Naked Archaeology from the Naked Scientists, and you can find more episodes like this at thenakedscientists.com/archaeology or on iTunes. Tom?
Let's now move even further into prehistory and explore the earliest use of fire in Europe. Paolo Villa and colleagues have collected together data from hundreds of sites across the continent, and they argue that 400,000 years ago, hominins were playing with the hot stuff. Further, this coincides with the date that we first see Neanderthals pottering about in Europe. Paolo Villa.
It was Darwin who first pointed out that the invention of fire was a very important issue in human evolution, as important as the invention of language. The question was related to the fact that there has been a controversy about the earliest evidence of fire on different continents, whether it could be as early as 2 million years, which is claimed by Richard Rangham, who is professor at Harvard, based on biology, that is the fact that the increase in the size of the human brain with the appearance of Homo erectus might have been the result of the use of fire, which means that food was cooked and the energy that was needed for digestion then could be diverted into other activities, and that facilitated the increase in brain size. Okay. Then there have been people claiming that there are sites in East Africa that are dated to 1.6 million years that show reddened patches of sediments, and the sediments are known to get reddier if there is a fireplace built on it. These red patches of sediments occur at archaeological sites made by either Australopithecines or early Homo fossils, but they are controversial because aside from the red patches of sediments, there are no burnt bones and no burnt stone artifacts with it.
So those are projected dates for origins of fire in Africa, and they're based on physiology and these red patches of earth. But what about Europe? What was going on there?
First of all, we have concentrated our interest in Europe because the number of sites is much, much larger for the time period between, say, 1 million years down to the end of the Paleolithic is a very large number of sites. And we looked then at two questions. One was that when is it that fire was introduced in early Europe? Because there again, most people believed or assumed that hominins migrating out of Africa into Europe must have had the use of fire because Europe is colder than Africa and you need fire to survive the cold winters. The second question that we dealt with was whether Neanderthals had habitual use of fire or whether they had just sporadic use of fire, maybe due to using opportunistically natural fires, and that it's only with the Upper Paleolithic that we see consistent and systematic use of fire. So we addressed these two questions from the point of view of archaeologists. There is a rather large literature that has been published. You need to speak several languages to read the excavation reports. In between me and Will, we read and speak 6 or 7 languages, that is, besides English. And also we know many archaeologists and we visited many sites.
And by doing that sort of meta-analysis, what did you find?
So for the first question, when is it that fire first appears in Europe, we find that contrary to the views of those who believe that hominids could migrate into Europe only if they had fire, that the earliest archaeological sites, that, which in Europe are dated, let's say, between 1.2 million years down to about 400,000 years ago, there is no evidence of fire, whether we are dealing with caves or open-air sites. As you know, the evidence of fire, unless you find an intact fireplace, which is rare, you can find, however, concentrations of ashes or charcoal. You can also find materials which are more resistant to destruction than ashes or charcoal. These are burnt bones and burnt artifacts that have been heated because they were near a fireplace. In some cases, we know that early hominids were also using bones as fuel.
And what do you see happening at about 400,000 years ago then?
Well, we have the two earliest sites where we have evidence of fire. One is an English site called Beach's Pit, and it's dated to about 400,000, where there are bones that are burned, which have been checked to burn at temperature of 600 to 800 degrees Celsius, which is much higher than a natural fire. Then there are red patches of sediments. The other site is the site of Germany called Schöningen. This is the famous site where 8 wooden spears had been found. And there is a wooden artifact which is charred, is burned at one end. It's quite clearly. I mean, it's possible the excavator thinks it might have been used to transport fire from one part or another of the site. And after that, after 400,000, we begin to find an increased number of sites that have good evidence of fire.
So how does that link to Neanderthals? What were they doing and what's this about making pitch?
But there is the increasing number of sites through time for the whole time period of presence of Neanderthals in Europe, which means the oldest Neanderthal fossil is 400,000 and then about 35,000 Neanderthals went extinct. This increase in the number of sites, I think the total is about 119, shows it's a technology that is slowly getting diffused and to us indicates that the Neanderthals had an habitual use of fire because you find sites that have many fireplaces or residues of fireplaces in different layers, one on top of each other. There is a site in Spain that has 187, what they call combustion structures. This is a sort of archaeological terminology, which means, when you use this term, it means either fireplaces or ash dumps when you clean up your fireplace. We also know that the Neanderthals were capable of producing pitch. Well, pitch is an adhesive. It has to be made by burning birch bark in conditions without air. And so it's a synthetic material. By burning slowly, these peels of bark produce a sticky liquid that was used by Neanderthals to haft their flakes or points onto the hafts. And there are three sites where this birch bark pitch has been preserved. Now, what were they waiting for, a lightning or a natural fire? Saying, okay, we sit here and wait until we can haft our stone tools. To me, all this suggests that they know how to make fires. Although, as I say, we don't know how.
That was Paola Via, curator adjoint at the University of Colorado, and her work is co-authored by Will Robrooks on the use of fire over 400,000 years ago, and it can be found in the journal PNAS. Now it's time for Backyard Archaeology, and this month Tom has been getting some practice in for the annual Aberdeen Beer Hunt.
Well, today I've turned up in the middle of a field, a park rather. It's sunny, it's windy, and I'm meeting up with my friend Mike Bumstead. Mike, why are we here in this field today, and why are there some long darts on the ground?
Well, we're going to learn about spear throwers today.
Ah, spear throwers, I see. Okay, so can you just describe what you've got in your hand for us, please? Okay,
well, I have two pieces of the technology that we refer to as spear throwers. One which is Native American, Central Native American in design, and it's an atl, something you would pronounce it differently in this part of the world.
Okay, wait, so let's just take a step back. we've got a spear thrower, and then you use this word atlatl. Yes. So there's different names for this thing.
Yeah, there are. Basically what it is a long stick with a hook on the end. Yeah. Sometimes it's grooved, sometimes it's not, with a counterbalance, which you use to throw darts, what we call spears, long, sharp objects at things.
Okay. So we call it the spear thrower. This other one you have in your left hand is the Inuit version, isn't it, from
yes.
the northern circumpolar regions. So some people might call that a throwing board. What's the Australian one?
The Australian one is called a Woomera. Now, unlike these ones that I have here, which are single-purpose objects, which have sort of a bone hook at the end, the Woomera is a longer, narrow, curved board, and it was a bit more multi-purpose. It had some of the existing examples have stone sharp edges placed on one side, and some of them, in fact, as I understand, were used as shields. Some of them were of this size, and so they more than just a single-use spear thrower.
Okay, so some spear throwers are multi-purpose. That's quite fascinating. The ones Mike are holding are quite different. The Native American one he's holding, which is a replica, has a stone weight about a third of the way down near the handle. And there's the bone point he's talking about. It's just a bit longer than my forearm, and I believe they should be about that size for an individual. I mean, how do you use them, Mike? Can you just show me, and I'll maybe describe to our listeners what you're doing? He's holding these 3.5-4 foot long darts. These are aluminium competition darts. You can use lights offwards, and there is a flight on the end, so it looks like a long arrow. I see. Can you just describe what you're doing, Mike?
All right, the darts have a nock in the back, so you place that upon the hook, this bone part at the end that we've been describing, we refer to as the hook. And then you hold the dart along the length of the board yeah. with the handle in your hand, and you hold the dart in the same hand as you hold the handle, sort of like a pen.
Okay, yeah, so at the moment Mike has got the spear thrower in his hand. He's holding it a little bit like a tennis racket or a badminton racket. And at the same time, on top of the spear thrower, he has the dart lodged into the nock, and he's balancing it on his thumb and first two fingers, a bit like a pen, yeah. So you're holding that now. What are you going to do with it?
I'm going to aim at the target that's been provided today, which is the box for a DeLonghi brand convection heater.
The rare mammalian species that has decided to grace us with its presence. Now, Mike, I'm just standing back for safety reasons. And, well, that's a long way, Mike. That's a long way. You've missed the target quite a bit.
Well, the target that we've had set up, which is set up for a practical class that we teach at the University of Aberdeen, is probably about 40 yards away from our position. And, of course, these kinds of technologies, these spear throwers, are not really designed for close-range hunting. So that being said, I'm also not very good with them, so I'm probably not going to hit your DeLonghi anyway.
Okay, well, second try. That's much closer, but that's great. So, I mean, that's a good 60 meters that's traveled. And how far can these things go, do you think?
Ancient technologies, I mean, we're using aluminium competition darts, so these actually flow quite far. I mean, you can throw them probably anciently 250, 300 meters.
Yeah.
The longest throws in the modern era are probably two times as long.
Yeah. Okay, that's quite a long distance. Now, with atlatl, one thing we have to mention is that this technology, compared to just throwing a spear with your hands, allows you to throw the dart much, much further. I mean, the dart and the spear, we must make a distinction here, mustn't we? They're different things, aren't they? Because this isn't... When I thought we were doing spear throwing today, this isn't a spear, Mike. This is a 3.5-4 foot long aluminium pole.
Yeah, I mean, these modern ones that we're using are... They're exactly as you've described them. They're really, really big arrows.
Yeah.
With this technology, when we say spear throwing, that's what we're talking about. We're not talking about javelins or a prodding stick with a stone tip on it, right?
That's the more traditional idea, and I think spear, I think 6 foot long staff, massive iron point on it. But we're not talking about that at all. We're talking about launching big arrows, basically.
Yeah, even that being said, those, what we think of as stereotypical spears, there was an evolution in how to throw those as well. Ancient Greeks used a leather strap that was tied around the base, and what you would do is, as you released it, it would serve the same purpose as these spear throwers that we're using, but it would also cause it to rifle. If you think about how a bullet works as it comes out of a modern firearm, the grooves are on the inside of the barrel to allow it to fly more stably and straighter. Those kinds of other strappings that were used at that point would serve the same effect. It helped to stabilize and straighten the flight of what you would say a more stereotypical spear would fly as.
Okay. So let's just have a... I might have a go in a minute, actually, Mike, if you wouldn't mind. I think I could give this a whirl. If you just hold that. Okay.
All right, you've got it set up. You've got it lined up.
Okay. I'm going to kill it. I'm going to kill the cardboard box.
All right, do it.
That was pretty bad. Okay, I'll just say for our listeners, it's not as easy as it looks, as Mike has demonstrated. I think I might have another go. So, despite my three attempts at throwing a spear with a spear thrower, I think we've concluded, Mike, that I'm not your natural hunter. But it's not always about hunting, is it? These were offensive weapons that were used. You were mentioning to me earlier about Montezuma.
Yes, the Aztecs were very well known for using these spear throwers. The Aztecs, in fact, when the conquistadors arrived in Spain, terrified them with the potential havoc that could be wreaked upon the Spanish with these weapons from a range that was well beyond the accuracy of their rifles. And it's really not until Cortez convinces them that he's their god and they let him in that trouble occurs for that particular civilization.
Locals beware. Thanks. That was Tom Birch and Mike Bumstead, postgraduate researcher at the University of Aberdeen. If you want to get in touch with any questions or comments, then please do. The address is archaeology@thenakedscientists.com. You've been listening to Diana O'Carroll, Tom Birch and Duncan Howitt-Marshall this month. And you can find more episodes just like this one at thenakedscientists.com/archaeology or on iTunes.
Coming to a trench near you, Naked Archaeology.
Think of your favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.